Donald Trump will be inaugurated as the 47th president of the United States on Monday.
The U.S. Capitol saw some protests Saturday, but overall, the atmosphere in this government transition period remains calm.
After a rocky start, the Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal is underway.
You know, I think it feels a little bit like the whole country was holding their breath since October 7th, 2023. And now, for the first time, there's kind of an exhale.
And hundreds of millions of people are gathering in India.
In the past 5 or 6 days, 70 million are already supposed to have taken a dip.
Today is Monday, January 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll be getting to Donald Trump and the inauguration in a few minutes, but we begin today in the Middle East. The ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas began Sunday, and after an early morning hiccup, Israel released busloads of Palestinians from Israeli jails, and Hamas released three hostages. U.S. President Joe Biden, on his last full day in office, spoke from Charleston, South Carolina, about the development. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has our story.
Freedom for the first three of 33 hostages to be released by Hamas in phase one of the deal. The Israeli military confirmed the handover as part of a recent ceasefire agreement. The International Committee of the Red Cross received the freed hostages, all of them women.
And after so much pain, destruction, loss of life, today the guns in Gaza have gone silent. I've worked in foreign policy for decades, and this is one of the toughest negotiations I've been part of.
The family of newly freed hostage Romy Gonin reacting to news of her release at a watch party in Israel. In exchange, Israel was freeing 90 Palestinian prisoners, 69 women, and 21 teenage boys. As part of the deal, in the next 6 weeks, Hamas will release 30 more hostages in exchange for about 2,000 Palestinians held by Israel. The truce clears the way for the flow of aid back into Gaza. And as for risks of the ceasefire collapsing, the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump says Hamas is backed in a corner. Trump's incoming National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, speaking on CNN's State of the Union show, is provided by the social media platform X.
They have no option except to let our hostages go. They cannot be a terrorist organization any longer, and they will never govern Gaza.
The deal itself was delayed by some 3 hours, during which Israeli warplanes launched attacks into Gaza. Palestinian medics say at least 13 people died. Israel says it was targeting terrorists. The hostage release and prisoner swap ceasefire deal comes after 15 months of fighting that reduced entire areas of the Gaza Strip to rubble. For displaced Palestinians returning home, it may be all they find as the drones and warplanes go silent. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And for a look at the deal from inside Israel, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
You know, I think it feels a little bit like the whole country was holding their breath since October 7th, 2023. And now, for the first time, there's kind of an exhale. The three young women appear to be in good condition. Hamas brought them to central Gaza. They were handed over to the Red Cross. And during that handover, in fact, there were thousands of Palestinians on the streets cheering, you know, that for Hamas, and dozens of armed Hamas gunmen who were kind of trying to control the situation. They were handed to the Red Cross. The Red Cross then took them to the border, and they were handed to Israeli soldiers, where they were reunited with their mothers first. They had a preliminary health check, and they seemed to be in relatively good health. And then they were flown to a hospital in Israel, where they will stay with their families for a few days.
And by all accounts, are things proceeding as planned?
So there was a little bit of a snag first thing in the morning when the ceasefire was supposed to come into force at 8:30 in the morning Israel time. But Israel said that Hamas had not provided the list of names of who would be released. And so it was delayed. And during that time, Israel continued attacking Gaza. And according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, in those attacks, 19 Palestinians were killed. And so the ceasefire didn't actually begin until almost 3 hours later.
And with regards to the Palestinian prisoners being released back to Gaza, how'd that go and who was released? Do we know?
There were 90 Palestinian prisoners released today, all women and children. Just like, you know, Hamas in this sort of ceasefire is releasing humanitarian cases, the Palestinians first are releasing humanitarian cases, but later on they're slated to release quite a few people who were convicted of bombings that killed a lot of Israelis. So there is kind of a mixed feeling about that.
Changing gears somewhat, humanitarian aid is also one of the tenets of the ceasefire deal. When can we expect to see that picking up?
It's already started. Dozens of trucks went in today. There was a huge buildup of humanitarian aid, both inside and outside Gaza. And the problem was the distribution. There was no way to get it to people. And now with the ceasefire, it should be more easily distributed. There's one kind of wrinkle, though, which is that Israel passed a law to shut down UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, which had been distributing a fair amount of this food, as well as running schools in the West Bank and Gaza. And that law is supposed to come into force sometime in the next month. So it's not clear who is going to replace UNRWA or how the aid will be distributed once that happens. And even now, you know, there's a lot of trucks coming in, but it's not clear that there's really a system set up for distribution or a place, you know, for people to go. People are still living in tents. It's very cold. You know, they're just now, there were some scenes of people clearing the rubble. People say they want to go back to their homes. Even if their homes are destroyed, they'll pitch a tent on the place where their home was. But only now is it beginning to be seen just how big the reconstruction of Gaza is going to be and just how much humanitarian aid is going to be needed.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for your reporting tonight.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
A deal like the one between Hamas and Israel is complicated enough. But when you add to it that it began the day before a new U.S. president was to be sworn in, you can see just how complicated it all is. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara looks at how the incoming administration might enforce the multi-phase deal and the president-elect's role in securing it.
Families living in Gaza refugee camps are hoping to return home as soon as the ceasefire and hostage release deal takes effect Sunday.
I will take my tent, remove the rubble of the house, and place my tent on the rubble.
It will be up to the incoming administration under Donald Trump and the international community to see that the three-phase deal is enforced. Preparations are underway for Trump's inauguration on Monday. Phase one of the deal includes withdrawal of Israeli forces from densely populated areas and more aid into Gaza, as well as the release of some Palestinians detained in Israeli prisons and some hostages held by Hamas, including Americans.
My concern is that the Trump administration will be so disinterested in Gaza after the ceasefire and after the retrieval of hostages that the agreement will amount to little more than a freezing of the conflict. And this will be disastrous for the people of Gaza.
As a key mediator of the deal, the Biden administration has progressively included Trump's team in peace talks, beginning with an Oval Office meeting a week after Trump won the election, the White House said. President Joe Biden announced the deal Wednesday.
This deal was developed and negotiated under my administration, but its terms will be implemented for the most part by the next administration. In these past few days, we've been speaking as one team.
Trump took credit immediately after the deal was announced, saying it only happened because of his victory. The reality is not quite as straightforward. But analysts say there is one role that Trump played both to Israel and to Hamas.
Trump injected a kind of fear factor into this process that was missing before.
Publicly, the U.S. faults Hamas for the failure of the talks, but some Israeli security officials and many observers also blame Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for blocking progress. Trump's victory may have changed the Israeli Prime Minister's calculations.
He can't triangulate anymore the way he would play Biden off of the Republican Congress. There's nowhere for Netanyahu to run, nowhere to hide, and so he took this deal he couldn't refuse.
Trump's pressure may have also created space for Netanyahu to resist ultimatums from far-right allies, including National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. They threatened to leave his governing coalition if a ceasefire deal is made. The pair voted against the deal, but it's unclear whether they will leave the government. Pat Suida Kuswara, VOA News at the White House.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Southeast Asian nations told Myanmar's military government on Sunday its plan to hold an election amid an escalating civil war should not be its priority, urging the junta to start dialogue and end hostilities immediately. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations called on the warring sides in member nation Myanmar to stop the fighting and told the junta's representative to allow unhindered humanitarian access. South Korea's impeached president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has been formally arrested days after being apprehended at his presidential compound in Seoul. He faces possible imprisonment over his ill-fated declaration of martial law last month. Yoon and his lawyers on Saturday appeared before the court's judge during a hearing and argued for his release. Supporters broke into the court and rioted. Nearly 90 were arrested. The death toll from the explosion of a gasoline tanker truck in Nigeria that killed people rushing to gather fuel has risen to 86, emergency services said on Sunday. Another 52 people suffered severe burns from the explosion. Witnesses say the people who were killed or burned had rushed to the site of the accident to try to collect spilled fuel, which has become very expensive in Nigeria, only to be engulfed by the flames when the tanker exploded. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. A look at a festival in India that is the largest gathering of people the world has ever seen, coming up in a few minutes. Now, though, as we've mentioned before, Donald Trump takes the oath of office Monday in Washington to become the 47th president of the United States, making him only the second president to serve non-consecutive terms. VOA's Tina Trin looks at Trump's political comeback.
Donald Trump says he was reelected with a, quote, unprecedented and powerful mandate from American voters.
I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president. And every citizen, I will fight for you, for your family and your future. Every single day, I will be fighting for you and with every breath in my body. I will not rest until we have delivered the strong, safe, and prosperous America that our children deserve and that you deserve.
Trump's return to power is part of his unwillingness to take no for an answer.
I think what you see is somebody who has incredible confidence in his own intuition.
Russ Mutner and Suzanne Craig are New York Times investigative reporters and co-authors of Lucky Loser, an unflattering look at how Trump fashioned himself into a self-made billionaire.
He has not, since the early 80s, really trusted people who have subject area expertise in almost anything. He will always overrule them to make things the way he wants them to turn out.
Trump's buildings were emblazoned with his name in large gold letters, a brash display of his ambition and self-promotion.
He was worth $200 million when he would talk. It was the interview he gave to the New York Times, and that grew to $1 billion when he was talking to 60 Minutes a decade later.
Trump excelled at drawing attention and cultivating a brand for himself as a dealmaker. He made millions licensing his name. But behind the success were troubles. His companies filed for bankruptcy 6 times. His casinos lost money and were shuttered. Trump rebounded with his TV show, The Apprentice, which led to his biggest role yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am officially running for President of the United States. and we are going to make our country great again.
Unapologetic and unfiltered, Trump was a polarizing nationalist candidate.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
As president, Trump appointed three Supreme Court justices who helped overturn federal abortion rights.
The U.S. death toll now above 150,000.
In early 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic tested Trump. He fast-tracked the development of life-saving vaccines, but he also appeared to suggest that scientists study injecting bleach to kill the virus. With over 9 million Americans infected and a death toll exceeding 230,000, voters that November chose Joe Biden as their next president. Out of office, Trump faced multiple criminal indictments and is the first former president to be a convicted felon. And yet, he has never been more popular. Surviving two assassination attempts this year has only strengthened the bond between him and his supporters.
God has a plan for Trump, and he absolutely was spared for some purpose and reason, and hopefully it's to become the 47th president.
American politics has never been the same since Donald Trump entered the field, and the man who once co-authored The Art of the Comeback is returning to power after engineering one of the biggest in American history. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
Cold weather has moved the inauguration ceremony indoors, but that doesn't change the enormity of the event. And even as this election cycle was noted for its heated rhetoric, there are some who believe Trump will adopt a conciliatory tone in his inaugural speech. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
A busy schedule for President-elect Donald Trump on the eve of his inauguration. His agenda included a wreath-laying ceremony at the tomb of the unknown soldier in Arlington National Cemetery, and a rally at the Capital One Arena in downtown Washington, the same venue where the inaugural parade is expected to take place Monday to protect attendees from the freezing temperatures that are forecast. The U.S. Capitol saw some protests Saturday, but overall, the atmosphere in this government transition period remains calm. Former Trump strategist Steve Bannon anticipates the president-elect will adopt a conciliatory tone after he's sworn in Monday for a second term in office.
I think he'll lay out the challenges, and he'll lay out the beginning in some sort of 60,000-foot level, what his policies and proposals are, but I think it'll all be about unifying the country and going forward together.
Democrats stand ready to work with the incoming administration, Democratic Senator Alex Padilla told ABC.
If we want to build on our progress from the last 4 years in record job creation, wage increases, record sustained low unemployment, and historic investments in our nation's infrastructure from an economic and security standpoint, that's great.
President Joe Biden made his last official trip Sunday to Charleston, South Carolina, where he marked Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the federal holiday, which also falls on Monday in honor of the civil rights leader. At least 25,000 law enforcement personnel are expected to be deployed to protect a smooth transfer of power from Biden to Trump on Inauguration Day. Veronica Valeras Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
The inauguration might be the biggest event in Washington, but the biggest event in the world right now is on the other side of the globe. Maha Kumbh Mela is a Hindu religious festival that happens once every dozen years in the city of Prayagraj, India, and it draws hundreds of millions of people. I'm joined by VOA's Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi.
I'll tell you the origin of the festival. The word Kumbh means pitcher or pot. So this festival has its origin in a myth according to which the gods and the demons churned the ocean in search of a pot of nectar of immortality. And during their fight over the pot, drops of the nectar fell at four cities where the Kumbh Mela events are now held. And one of them is Prayagraj, which is the most significant. Now, the ritual at the heart of this festival is a dip in what Hindus believe are the holy waters at Prayagraj. You know, this city is home to the confluence of the Ganges, Yamuna, and a mythical river, all of which Hindus consider sacred. And devotees are drawn by the belief that a plunge in these waters cleanses them of sins and helps them achieve salvation from the cycle of birth and rebirth in which Hindus believe. So that is what, you know, makes this a sort of huge spectacle of religion, of devotion, of spirituality. And of course, the sheer numbers that descend here are mind-boggling.
Well, you're not kidding when you say a huge show of devotion. This is the largest gathering of humans in the world. How many people are expected to come this time, and how are authorities preparing for this just massive influx of people?
Absolutely. I think authorities are expecting the numbers to cross 400 million. I mean, that's absolutely staggering.
That would be the third most populated country in the world.
Absolutely. But we can believe this because in the past 5 or 6 days, 70 million are already supposed to have taken a dip. That's huge. The scale of it is really something quite staggering. Now, how have the authorities prepared for it? They have built a tented city, which is spread over 4,000 hectares, to accommodate the crowds. The tents, of course, go all the way from luxury ones to very basic ones because the crowd is very diverse. There are people, ordinary people who come in. There are the rich Indians who come in, foreign tourists, etc. Now, this tented city includes toilets, medical tents, and even booths earmarked for missing persons because that's very common. People get separated. Power substations have been set up to illuminate the site. What is new this time is that they brought in high technology to tackle the challenge of safety, which is one of the biggest threats at such an event, because crowd crushes are common and have happened in the past. There is an AI-powered surveillance system which is monitoring the CCTV cameras and drones to measure crowd density. It is supposed to alert authorities when there is overcrowding, say at entry points, at bathing areas, etc. Of course, it's just too early to say how all this will work on the ground. We'll have to wait and see. And there are 40,000 security personnel and police on duty.
Well, as you mentioned, people in the past have been killed in crushes or stampedes. And I know from what you've said that authorities are working on security and crowd control, also security from outside forces who might wish to do harm. Another problem in the past has been the rapid spread of diseases. When you have that many people so close to each other and also who are literally bathing together, diseases would spread very easily. How are authorities tackling that problem?
I don't think there is that much attention to that aspect of it. I don't know why. But yeah, you know, there are 150,000 toilets have been laid. There are temporary pipelines and 15,000 sanitation workers. What you mentioned about cleanliness of the waters, that I don't think they really do anything to clean the water as such every day. So how hygiene is maintained through the 45 days really remains to be seen. But I can assure you the show will go on because the fervor is huge.
The fervor is huge. The crowd is huge. It is, of course, a Hindu festival in a Hindu country. And right now, the government is a Hindu nationalist government. Is there any politicking going on at what ought to be a religious event?
Yeah, the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party government has definitely gone the extra mile to organize the festival and to publicize it. They've set aside $800 million to organize all the facilities, which I spoke about earlier. Promoting such events is definitely part of their strategy to cultivate their support base among India's majority Hindu community. And, you know, religion has become more an overt part of the political discourse since they came into power about 10 years ago. In fact, interestingly, Prayagraj, the city where it is being held, was earlier known as Allahabad by a Muslim name. That was changed by this government to a Hindu name. They say it's part of the process of reclaiming the Hindu heritage of the country. And there was also, let me mention this, there was also a proposal to ban Muslims from operating shops at the festival arena by a right-wing Hindu group, but this has not been imposed.
Anjana Pasricha covers India for The Voice of America. Anjana, thank you for your time. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve. It was good speaking to you.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.